In the early 1980s, when Michelle Dorns began to study dance as a child in Chapel Hill, tap dance was going through a rebuilding phase. Though many of the legends of its jazz and bebop eras were still alive, they were aging out of active performance. Tap wouldn't regain mainstream popularity again until the 1990s. That timing was fortuitous for Michelle, who'd continued to study and perform tap throughout her childhood and adolescence. By the time the tap musical Bringin' Da Noise, Bringin' Da Funk became a smash Broadway hit in 1996, her commitment to the craft was paying off. She joined the cast of that show and some of the others that emerged during the 90s and solidified her place as one of the foremost tap dancers of her generation. Michelle founded Dorns Dance in 2011 to teach the craft to aspiring performers, won a MacArthur Genius Grant in 2015, and continues to find ways to honor tap history while innovating the art form. Michelle Dorns, welcome back to The State of Things.
Hi, thank you for having me. Let me make a quick correction to the announcement. Just that maybe it was just a phrasing, but I did not join the cast of Noise Funk. I definitely moved to New York City when it was on Broadway, but they were my inspirations. That was certainly not a show that I was a part of.
Got it. A big inspiration for you.
A huge inspiration, and certainly the inspiration for moving to New York City.
Well, so you are back in North Carolina now, kind of waging the pandemic with your family. What has it been like to be back here?
I mean, North Carolina is one of my favorite places on the entire planet. Chapel Hill specifically is just really beautiful. And I love where my family's home sits and kind of on the edge of town. We have the woods in our backyard and the railroad tracks that sort of traverse Chapel Hill and Carrboro. It's just a really beautiful place to be. And it's so rare that I get to spend this kind of time with my family. And it's while this is a really challenging time and kind of harrowing time for the country and for a number of reasons, I'm really grateful to be with my family during this time.
I know that you definitely got your start here, and this is a really special place for tap dance in the country. As you think back to those early memories while you're home now, kind of how do you tie the thread between those early memories and where you are in your career now?
The only reason I am who I am is because of the foundation that I have here, that I, you know, my foundation education and also just love for tap dance and the arts in general. It was all born from my time spent in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, specifically with my mentor, Gene Medler.
Tell me more about Gene.
Yeah, Gene, it's unbelievable. I like to start with the fact that he didn't start tap dancing until he was 27. And because everyone talks about people starting to dance late, you know, when they're 12 or in their teenage years. But Gene started studying when he was 27 and fell in love with tap dance. And I think because of his love for the dance, the dance and the art form, he sought out what was happening in the early 80s through to the early 90s, these very, very first gatherings of tap dancers in New York City and then Colorado and Portland, like very few cities and kind of random places, but I know New York City makes sense. But he sought these gatherings out and studied with, as you mentioned before, these living masters that were present in the 80s and 90s of, you know, basically tap dance's heyday. And because of this love for not just pursuing the form and his own knowledge, he truly became a master educator, and his generosity in sharing that with us and then inviting us into those spaces is what makes our experience growing up in North Carolina, those of us who were around at that time, very unique.
We're going to talk more about that education and how it inspired you as an educator as we continue our conversation just ahead with Michelle Dorns, dancer, choreographer, and founder and artistic director of Dorns Dance. Stay with us on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Michelle Dorns' passion for tap dance came early. So did her understanding that it didn't often receive the same respect as other dance forms. Many in professional dance circles viewed tap as mere entertainment, flourishes of hands and pats of feet, meant to enhance an old Hollywood film or keep a live audience engaged. Michelle learned that this was in part because of tap's African and early Black American influences and the long history of segregation in American theater and professional dance. Michelle Dorrance is the founder and artistic director of Dorrance Dance and my guest this hour. So you mentioned earlier your mentor, Gene Medler, and how much emphasis he put on the importance of history and learning the history of the dance form. And that was a big part of your education at a young age. Can you tell me a bit more about how that informed how you approached learning the form as a dancer?
Absolutely. I mean, Gene really integrated them. They were one and the same. The history was a part of why we were executing a certain step. Or, you know, I think this is something that is really important as far as tap lineage is concerned, because it really has an oral, tradition in history. The reason he would approach the floor this way is because a technique he learned from Honey Coles. The reason he might do a shuffle over here is because of something that he saw Savion Glover do. These are all important tools when passing anything down that has a cultural legacy or tradition. But also, he took us to these gatherings where our masters were teaching, you know, legends of the form from, you know, the really 30s, 40s, and 50s. And he'd stand side by side in class with us. I mean, Gene was such an unbelievably humble leader. And he'd remind us, do you remember what Diane Walker said in this class? He would constantly keep the narrative of the history alive inside of the way he would teach the technique. And I think that is the one true way to honor it as an educator. And then inside of performing with his youth ensemble that he formed at the time, known as the Children's Tap Company, and then developed into the North Carolina Youth Tap Ensemble, you know, one of our big performance opportunities as young, you know, kids was doing lecture demonstrations for other children in schools. And inside of those lectums, we would talk about the history and talk about the influences and then perform different cultural traditions. In fact, one learned from Ruth Pershing, who studied with John D. Holman, and so we would do a traditional flat foot and traditional ham bone from, you know, our local area.
I want to play a clip from an album that inspires you and inspired part of your technique. This is from an album. I don't know the year of it, but Baby Lawrence Dance Master. And this title is The Sand. So let's take a listen, and then we'll talk more with Michelle. So that was The Sand, a track from the album Baby Lawrence Dance Master. And this is from the musician Baby Lawrence, who was one of the great musicians of the jazz and bebop era. So tell me about him and what we're hearing in that piece.
What I love is that you called him a musician, because tap dancers are musicians. Mm-hmm. And that is the first thing that folks, I think, come to realize when understanding the sophistication of the form, that it is a dance form and also a musical form at the same time. So Baby Lawrence was one of the great bebop era tap dancers, and this is something that tap dance is very overlooked in the history of both American music and dance. Tap dance's influence on American music is huge. And if you don't mind me just taking this opportunity to do like a very, very brief, you know, exploration of that.
Sure, yeah.
Tap dance, so we look back to the beginning of jazz music. So tap dance predates what we consider, you know, the beginning of jazz, right? So tap dance born of truly on the plantation and also throughout the metropolitan areas of the North. You have hundreds of years of development of percussive dance and body percussion. And then you have the earliest stride piano player saying, well, I was just imitating my favorite tap dancer. So literally the feel of, you know, the original swing feel of the piano is rooted in tap dance. Tap dance, a pattern that was developed by tap dancers through the 1800s, was 6 bars of a rhythm and a 2-bar break. Now, this is literally the pattern for popular drumming in America. So, and I'll give you an example. Like, if you were to think of a rock beat, something that has nothing to do with what people think has nothing to do with tap dance, right? So you think like doom doom cat doom 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 cat doom 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 cat doom doom, just simple boom boom cat, and then you hear a break like ba da da dum gong ga gong gong. So that's 6 bars of a pattern and two bars of a break. This is a pattern that's developed by tap dance, and then you move to who we were just speaking of, Baby Lawrence, and the bebop era, popularized by brilliant horn players. The honest horn players say they were really imitating the syncopation and really diverse rhythmic, you know, elements of the drummers. And the drummers that are honest say, well, we were really just copying the tap dancers.
Hmm.
So Baby Lawrence is one of those dancers. What you just heard him doing here is actually a very, very old tradition called sand dancing that a number of tap masters through the years, and generations, really, it's passed on through many generations, were practitioners of, most notably Sandman Sims and then Harriet Quicksand Brown. And Gene had the opportunity to meet and Sandman Sims, and I had the opportunity to learn Harriet Brown's suite that she set on Manhattan Tap, a company I spent time dancing with. But with that said, it's a really unique technique where you use leather-soled shoes with a couple handfuls of sand on a wooden surface or inside of a little sandbox that you've built. And the technique changes a little bit because you're trying to get the most out of the texture of the sand on the wood, but still a percussive dance tradition also dating back literally to the 1800s.
So you had this mentor, Gene Medler, who really introduced you to these greats, introduced you to the art form and its history. You also were the child of two people who care a lot about footwork. Your mom, a professional ballet dancer. Your father, an icon in North Carolina athletics, the head coach of the UNC women's soccer team. So talk about how movement was kind of talked about in your family. Was it inherent to just being a family member that you kind of learned how to move? Or how do you attribute your kind of evolution of movement to those early upbringing?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I mean, my mom is such a beautiful dancer. I mean, she was a professional ballet dancer. And my father, both my parents are actually incredibly quick, both with their feet, obviously. But my father was a drummer in high school before, you know, becoming a soccer coach, mogul, or icon. But they both love music and are very musical people.
Hmm.
On top of, you know, my dad's pursuit of athletics involves a tremendous amount of movement. And, of course, my mom is a professional mover, was and is an educator. And I think there wasn't ever really a conversation. I just absolutely started dance as soon as I could in the school that my mom founded, the Ballet School of Chapel Hill. And I started, you know, rec soccer at a young age as well. Because both of my parents were, you know, incredibly successful in their forms, I learned early on what it took to be that successful, you know, in what they were both pursuing. My father at the time in the 80s, you know, into the early 90s, was coaching the U.S. women's national team on top of coaching the men and the women at North Carolina. So I knew that I wasn't as fast necessarily. I was quick, but not as fast as the women on the national team. Like, I knew that I didn't have the turnout and I had pretty flat feet, you know, for ballet. So I learned these things from my parents on top of learning, you know, the traditions and, you know, I think really it's just discipline that you have to have in order to achieve anything. So of course I learned a tremendous amount of that from both of them. But I think my gift actually lied inside of my musical understanding. And since you mentioned movement, I would say my embodiment of music as movement, because that's really what's beautiful about tap dancing.
So what made you went on to New York City, but instead of choosing to study dance, you actually went to NYU and you thought about being a philosophy major first, I think, right? But then you kind of created your own major at NYU. So tell me about that decision to not explicitly study dance performance in college.
Well, you mentioned it a little bit in the introduction of the segment. There are honestly not a lot of institutions of higher learning have a respect for tap dance as something to study in, you know, the walls of higher education. So, which is strange because jazz is so embraced, right, by these institutions. And I found that, you know, in most dance departments, not only was tap not represented well, there were some dance departments that did not believe in it being supported, and that was a huge turnoff for me. I had a lot of interest academically, so I went to my dad was a philosophy major, and my younger brother also eventually was a philosophy major, and I was just interested in, you know, learning. I was interested in opening my mind, but what I found was that my interest and my passions academically were really interdisciplinary, and so the Gallatin School of Individualized Study that I transferred into at NYU was really my home and was a home for that kind of thinking. So in, you know, relationship to tap dance as this, you know, actually kind of subversive and powerful American art form that represents more, and that telling the story of tap dance really tells the true history and you know, fights against racial injustice that pepper the history of the United States. I think it's really important that, you know, there are more opportunities to have an interdisciplinary model in university. So I was really grateful to be able to study American history, study civil rights, study, you know, in my own way, the impact that different tap dancers had on, you know, sociopolitically. And, you know, I was lucky to be able to pursue these interests inside and be credited for it, because it sounds kind of ridiculous when I try to explain what my major was to people. But I think it was really just my passion for the, you know, very different traditions of, you know, academic study.
So as a white young woman then at this university trying to understand kind of race and democracy and all of that through the lens of tap dance, what did you learn about black women and their role in the tap dance history? There are not many names that are really well known of black women tap dancers.
No, there are not. And I think that this is something that the nation at this very moment is coming to terms with in every direction. That just the erasure of black women and their contribution to our world, to who we are, to our culture, to our history, to our academics, to industry, to everything. There is not a part of life that this erasure has not happened and that these women have not touched. So actually, I'd love to take this time to say the names of some of these women. And a lot of these women, we don't even have a lot of footage of. So there are these great movie musicals, which is a huge part of the institutionalized racism inside of entertainment. We know Fred Astaire, we know Ann Miller, we know Eleanor Powell, we know Gene Kelly, we know all these names. And some folks know Sammy Davis Jr., mm-hmm. which is great, but we don't know a lot of the hoofers that I met when I was a young person, like Jimmy Slide, like Buster Brown, Charlie Atkins, Henry Letang, and Peg Leg Bates. We also really don't know a lot of the women. One of the women that I met during this time was Jenny Ligon, and she was signed to MGM, was an unbelievable black female soloist, tap dance soloist, which was almost unheard of at the time. And she came out of a vaudeville troupe, one of the most successful vaudeville shows and organizations in the history of vaudeville, run by the Whitman sisters. And Alice Whitman was known to be one of the greatest tap dancers ever. Every man will attest to this almost begrudgingly of that time, and then that those stories have been passed down. And all we have about the Whitman sisters are writings. And so then you move to a woman that straddles those generations is Cora LeRed. We only have one little clip of her dancing, an unbelievable dancer. We have Baby Edwards, who is featured in the documentary Plenty of Good Women Dancers, who we should know. Lois Bright of the Miller Brothers and Lois. And then a woman who had a huge impact on me that was really a vernacular dancer, vocalist, and tap dancer, Mabel Lee. So I just want to say these names because we don't know these women. And there are so many more, but it's one of those things where you're digging into history books written largely by white men. And the history of tap dance, which is peppered with a handful of women, but mostly champions men, and it's devastating. And there are so many women that have been educators, very specifically Diane Walker, who have educated an entire generation of dancers, specifically my generation and the generations under myself. So, this is a tradition that is carried by really brilliant women of color and whose names are very often not spoken.
So as you came to learn about them and learn about their history as you were coming to be as a dancer once you were in New York City, talk about kind of your big next step after school that kind of let you know that this is going to be a profession. This is going to be something that continues on for the remainder of your career, or at least for the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I've told that the story a lot, that I didn't ever plan to be a professional tap dancer, but I knew it was something I would do until I died. Like, it's who I am. It's my favorite, you know, part of myself. And it's my passion. So, of course, I took gigs during college. I had an opportunity to leave to do a show. And actually, Diane Walker, who I mentioned earlier, was like, I don't know if this is the show. I don't think you need to go to Germany and leave school. Go ahead and graduate, and let's see what happens. And while I was still in school, in fact, my senior year at NYU, Savion Glover brought a bunch of us together, dancers of my generation, and started a crew or a company. People want to call it different things, but really... we were dancing together, rehearsing together, and then he was someone that would bring you to, you know, very high-end gig, because that was, you know, he was literally one of the only tap dancers that was known of his generation during that time by the masses. And so that opportunity led to more performance opportunities for our group that he organized, which we were known as Tie-Dye, T-I-D-I-I. And that also led me to dance with a number of other companies. And, you know, of course, in New York City at the time, there's not really a lot of money behind tap dance, and, you know, especially tap dance companies. But there was so much to be learned by my elders and my teachers who had founded these companies, like Max Pollock, Barbara Duffy, Manhattan Tap, like I mentioned before, with Heather Cornell. And I even, knowing the tradition that a few folks that were older than myself, Dormisha, and Derek Grant, Sam Weber, another notable man, had danced with Jazz Tap Ensemble under Lynn Daly's direction. So I had these opportunities to dance with a number of different companies right out of school, and also continue to pursue the dance as a soloist.
So you went on to be in Stomp for about 4 years, and I just watched Hamilton, the TV version on Disney this weekend. And it just got me thinking about the extreme amount of energy put into those shows, and just how performers do that night after night after night. And I'm wondering for you, I mean, doing that kind of high intensity, big production like Stomp for 4 years, what was that experience like for you?
Yeah, one of my friends used to call it the bone crusher, just because so many people were getting injured during this period of time. But, and also, like, what I literally, those companies I just mentioned, I jumped into Stomp after, you know, a number of years of dancing as a soloist with my peers and my homies, and, you know, a number of companies. And, you know, it's a hustle, and also teaching. Like, so the opportunity to be a part of a show and to learn, you know, the legacy of that show, which is really brilliant. And has attracts so many different kinds of artists. That's what really keeps you going. You know, in one cast, you have a master Brazilian percussionist, a world champion snare drummer, and, you know, an actor that was flipping burgers until he got the gig. Like, there are so many different kinds of folks that are, and, you know, vocalists that are unbelievable that join the cast of that show, that there's just a lot to be learned, you know, inside of the, you know, I guess, culture and environment there. But also, I just learned a ton about preserving my body, that it is something, you know, Stomp is unique in that, you know, most Broadway shows, you have to perform 8 shows a week, and Stomp an off-Broadway show, so not exactly the same, you know, union rules. They would try not to make you perform more than 6 shows a week in order for your body to last for a number of years inside of, you know, this work. But I think body preservation was a huge thing that I learned, but also I really appreciated the compositional structure of the show. I think it taught me a lot about, you know, I loved being a soloist and I loved composing and choreographing as a tap dancer, but it really helped me understand what one of the things I love most about tap dance, which is groove. And that kind of music that brings a group of people to nod their head or rock their body or tap their foot together. That could, like, what are the unifying elements of rhythm? And groove is one of them. And so I learned a tremendous amount about that from Stomp.
Wonderful. We will continue our conversation just ahead with Michelle Dorrance as she stays with us to talk more about founding her own company, Dorrance Dance, and the future of tap. Please stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. I'm talking with Michelle Dorrance today. Michelle is a Chapel Hill native, a renowned dancer and choreographer, and the founder of Dorrance Dance in New York. So before the break, you were talking about kind of learning about your body and learning about its limits and learning about body preservation. How do you, I mean, in terms of like a daily routine or practice, I mean, what do you have to do to keep up the agility that you need for this type of dance form?
Gosh, I wish I could have a great answer for you right now. It's the pandemic. This is awful. All of my discipline has fallen into the trash can. I honestly, on an ideal, that's not entirely true. There was a period of time where the first thing I was doing was waking up and doing a pretty extreme workout. What I have to do now, because I've broken both my feet, and which actually is not that bad of an injury. A really bad ankle sprain is much worse than, of course, any kind of tear. Like, I've been very lucky to only have broken my fifth metatarsal of both my feet, which is known as like the dancer's fracture. It happens to a lot of people. But one thing I have to do, in part because my feet are flat, is roll my feet out quite a bit.
Like with a tennis ball?
A lot of us use lacrosse balls.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, a hard lacrosse ball. I need to roll my glutes out because if anyone's ever noticed who's listening, tap dancers are very calf and quad strong. And the things that we, you know, this is like super niche information, but we really need to strengthen our hamstrings and our glutes. So that's something that I spend some time stretching and hopefully strengthening and rolling out as well.
I
wish I had a routine I stuck to. I'm sorry to say that. I'm really sorry to say it.
Well, how much time a day do you actually spend tapping and dancing and trying to choreograph?
Now that you have mentioned that I started a company, and it's sort of a blessing and a curse because I believe in supporting other dancers almost more than anything. I love sharing other dancers and their voices with the world, but I did not think I was starting a business, nor did I think I was going to become an administrator. And so the amount of time that I spend dancing every day varies drastically depending on what the other sort of tasks in order to support, you know, the things that we do are. So I've learned quite a bit about the fact that if I don't prioritize my own dancing for myself, no one else is going to prioritize that for me. No one's going to say, oh, Michelle, make sure you get off your email, or I'm so sorry, you have 70 emails today. Like, make sure you go practice. You know, make sure you have some time to create. Like, this is the interesting thing about anyone who lives in, you know, an artistic realm and found something that they at first are the sole administrator of, and now I have an incredible team of people, like unbelievable team. But that doesn't mean that I don't still get sucked into that kind of work. So staying physical, and I think this is something that folks who are sheltering in place can really identify with, just making sure that you don't lose sight of your passions and the things that bring you joy in order for you to bring others joy. So that's what I can say for that.
Well, will you dance a little bit for us now? We'll get you into, you know, your warm-up at least, dancing for
Absolutely.
Us.
Absolutely. yeah, funny. My tap dance warm-up will vary depending on what is inspiring me rhythmically in the moment. And since we were just listening to Baby, I'm just going to swing a little bit. So I won't take too long because I'm going to put the phone down for a second. But here we go.
Okay. Michelle Dorrance tapping live for us, tapping live on the radio, something we don't
just
get to say every day.
Right.
Well, so as a choreographer, I mean, take me from kind of origin to final performance. Like, does it start with a rhythm in your head and then the movement flows from there and then you think of a concept and then, you know, eventually becomes a full-scale performance? Or how does that thread work?
Honestly, oftentimes it does. I'd say, yeah, music... either music in my head, literally like something I want to explore rhythmically with my feet, those rhythms often come first. Sometimes a piece of music is really moving me, and that's what inspires other rhythms, and that's what inspires other ideas. And that's not to say that I haven't had a concept inspire me, but even in the realm of that kind of conceptual work, it's almost stripped away in the moment when something rhythmic is calling you. And so, you know, I always answer this, and I always say music first, rhythms first, all day, all day. And it's true. Even when I have other ideas and I know that I'm going to serve those ideas at some point, and I know that I'm going to seek and I'm going to make decisions about the way the arc and the momentum of something I'm building helps to communicate that idea or that emotion, or, you know, what hopefully the ways that we can open our minds or we can open an audience's mind by dancing in front of them, which is such an abstract idea. It's crazy. But, you know, these are the things that we hope to do. And in the end, if I don't trust my instinct rhythmically, none of that will matter. So I keep coming back to this because I'm like, am I full of crap when I answer this question? Because a lot of people ask me. No, it's interesting. And so I'm having a moment of self-reflection on it right now. But it's my happy place. It's my sad place. It's my angry place. Like, it is my most honest place. And so if I don't start here with that, with something rhythmic, with something that feels right in my bones, or something that feels, you know, the music that comes out of your body, you're literally standing on your feet, and your feet are the things making the music, you know. So if it doesn't come from that place, or it doesn't come from, you know, one of our elders or teachers, or, you know, if it doesn't come from these really deep, deep places, even if it comes from the idea that one of those cats told you, you know, you can't just imitate me, you have to make it your own, and then you're like, okay, this has to be mine. It just doesn't feel honest, and if it's not honest, it's never going to communicate any of those other, you know, places of inspiration.
So you mentioned starting your company and not necessarily being prepared for it to be a business, or to think about the business sides of it. But I wonder, I mean, in this moment, you know, when there's this big reckoning that we spoke about at the beginning of the show about institutional racism and systemic racism, and for someone like you who is so committed to teaching and exploring the history of this art form as rooted in the Black community, how do you build in kind of consciousness around race and around the history of this form into kind of the structure of your company? Is that something you're thinking about all the time when you're hiring dancers, when you're thinking about kind of whose music to bring into the productions? How do you think about it from kind of a bigger systemic level?
I mean, honestly, I think a lot of the origins of the company and the origins of who I'm working with and what's on the stage are really instinctive or intuitive. And it should be a reflection of what you're doing in your life and who you're surrounding yourself with and by. I've never had auditions for the company for that reason. I have such brilliant peers and such brilliant dancers who are students of mine and friends of mine that you reach out to your friends and you reach out to your students and you reach out to those whose voices are brilliant and unsung, and also just those who are kind to one another. I think this is another really important thing, you know, and this is, you know, there's like the kind of legend of the genius jerk, right?
Mm-hmm.
That someone can be a really brilliant artist or brilliant athlete or brilliant person, but they're not nice. And I don't believe in that. And I think, you know, one thing that's really important in relationship to this time where we are, you know, hopefully the nation is focused on fighting racial injustice and, you know, concentrated on abolition, concentrated on, you know, ridding structures of these horrible traditions that are woven into the fabric of the country. We have to remember that the way we treat one another is at the root of this. So while it is absolutely important to me that the you know, my company looks like a cross-section of New York City, because we are, you know, while it's important to me that, you know, the musicians and artists that we collaborate with are unique unto themselves and also will always offer us new perspectives and, you know, continue to ask more of us. We also always have to be kind to one another. And it's something that I've learned over time that, you know, that is, you know, decolonizing, like to have a kindness at the kind of core of who we are as artists and people is really important. And we always have to remind each other. I mean, it's not that tense moments don't arise when we're creating. It's hard. But, you know, I think that working with human beings that you value and to value all human beings is how to create something that is truly special and, you know, continues to move against and fight against injustices. So, and this is something we've been talking about, you know, over the past month as a company. A handful of times we've just had conversations where we'll sit on Zoom, we'll sit in silence until someone's ready to speak. And I think what's really beautiful is that every company member, you know, black, white, golden, as Claudia likes to call herself, and yellow, as some other folks like to call themselves, that we love each other and care about each other and feel safe in a space together. So building those spaces is really important, but also being able to, you know, push the country towards honoring that this should be a space for that as a nation is something that is revolutionary, and we can't stop the fight until it's done.
Do you see tap dance itself and tap dance choreography as a tool of protest to be used in your company moving forward?
I mean, tap dance is a black form that so many institutions until very recently didn't respect. Like, putting a black form in a white space, I think, is a hugely important thing. But also, telling the history of this form is so important. So it's a rare event when we are touring and don't have lecture demonstrations alongside performances. And that's for elementary schools, for universities, for audiences, you know, of all kinds. It doesn't really matter. But talking about the history of the form is so important. I mean, we have revolutionaries inside of the history of the form. National Tap Dance Day is Bill Bojangles Robinson's birthday. Bill Bojangles Robinson was a huge advocate for social change and fought racial injustice his entire life. He was the first black soloist as a tap dancer to break the two-colored rule of vaudeville that prohibited solo black performers. He refused to wear blackface. He and Shirley Temple were the first black and white hands to be held on the silver screen. Like, tap dancers are revolutionaries through the ages. And this is something that is really important for the country to understand. And also, you know, this form has brilliant sophistication and incredible depth, and the history is not often told. The history, you know, again, written mainly by white men, does not honor it very often as a truly diasporic form, that it is from, you know, West Africa and then developed in the Americas. I mean, it's really interesting to see the erasure of these things, you know, constant, including during my lifetime. It's maddening.
What is next for you? I mean, you've been in Chapel Hill, you've been staying in touch with your company. I'm sure you've been kind of creating and also feeling antsy, as many of us have. How are you thinking about the next 6 months, the next year for you and your company?
Honestly, this is a big question mark for a lot of people in the performing arts. So when are we going to be able to gather in a space with 1,000 people? Like, really think about that. Like, a lot of folks are thinking about that. So what do we need to do to continue to, you know, share what we do, because we also believe in live performance, not just, you know, recreating everything in a digital realm. So does that mean touring with a big truck that unfolds into a stage outside in parking lots or huge grassy areas? Does that, you know, do we need to reinvent the idea of sharing what we do in a unique way? Yeah, I think so. And do we need to, you know, while it's still warm outside, find some really amazing places to dance together, quarantine together, create together, and there are a number of dancers and musicians that are really excited to jump back into it. And then some folks are scared, which I also respect. I think in the end, the dancers in the company, I want it should be decided democratically always. And then, you know, one thing that is after, you know, my heart in creating the company in the first place, it was never meant to be just a company where I create work. I believe in collaboration, and there are so many brilliant tap dancers out there, my peers and my elders, that the world should know. So if what I do is continue to, of course, you know, champion the dancers and the brilliant artists that I already work with, but also to help point towards the other dancers and creators in our tradition that are often not, you know, given the same limelight. Like, if my role as an advocate or producer should push that now, then I absolutely believe in that as well.
We don't have much time left, but I'd love for you to just situate tap in this moment in history. Where are we right now in the big timeline of tap as an art form and how people think
of
it?
Oh my gosh, it's amazing. There are more young practitioners of tap dance at a high level than there ever have been. Like I just mentioned, my peers and friends and elders in the form are brilliant. They're innovators. Tap dance is one of the most cutting-edge forms in the arts world, period. I mean, I'm biased, but It's unbelievable. Dance and music at the same time. Everyone should be supporting tap dance. Everyone anywhere should be supporting tap dance. It is unbelievable. It's incredibly powerful, and it is the history and the tradition that we should continue to look to in relationship to, you know, the immigrated America, in order to understand how we need to better support this art form and Black people.
Wonderful. Michelle Dorrance is a dancer, choreographer, and founder and artistic director of Dorrance Dance in New York. Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find out more about her, her work, her company, and everything we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Amanda Magnus, Grant Holub-Mormon, Kaya Finlay, and Stacia Brown. Josie Taras is our intern, and Jenny Lawson is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.